This week I'm joined once again by philosopher Wouter Kustus to discuss his book, A Philosophy of Madness, The Experience of Psychotic Thinking, alongside discussions on psychosis, time, and phenomenology. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support Hermetics or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Wouter Kustus, thanks very much for joining us once again on Hermetics podcast.
Thank you.
We briefly, last time I titled it, the Philosophy of Madness, our last discussion, which is the title of your book. So we're going to be discussing your book, A Philosophy of Madness, The Experience of Psychotic Thinking, which is now published with MIT.
Yes.
Last time, I only had a few sort of extracts to take the whole conversation from, and this time I've got the whole book very kindly. Yes. From MIT, and I've read the whole thing, and just to briefly describe it, this is very positively dense philosophical text on what madness is, what psychosis is, what to a certain extent neuroticism is, what are these experiences and states that we have in fits of madness, or in, what is the madman, where is he, what's he doing? And it's touching on, it is touching on the metaphysics, it's touching on the largely the epistemology, how do Yes. we, how do we know these mad states? And at the same time, it's interspersed with, a historical dialogue, or I should say a histo-philosophical dialogue of a history of madness, but understood philosophically.
Yes.
And there is so much in here, I can't really do it a service by just briefly explaining it. So, I'll hand that question over to you. It's a tough one for anyone who's written a book, and especially a philosophical one. But what is your book about?
Well, thank you very much, James, for this introduction into my book, which gives indeed a perspective on my book. Let me just give the whole the large framework and the three main theses. Initially, I started to write the book because I was psychotic once in 1987 already, and no one knew what a psychosis was like, and also psychiatrists and also psychologists in their descriptions of what it is like to be psychotic, I was never content. That didn't make sense, I think. And then I put it on paper in my first book. This is the book before this philosophy of madness thing. Pure Madness, it's called. It's only in Dutch. This Pure Madness book was a research into this experience of being psychotic. My first thesis is that to examine what psychosis is, what a psychotic process is, what a psychotic transition is, the best way to examine that is to use philosophy, because psychology, psychopathology, and psychiatry all have these presuppositions about what a human being is, what human life is, and what experience would be. And in ordinary psychology, psychiatry, psychopathology, the main threat is that they know what normal life is, and the deviations, like psychotic experience, that there is a certain lack of something. So this, they describe psychosis, a psychotic experience, as lacking something. You do not have order, you have disorder. You are not coherent, you are incoherent. That's what they say. You are not living in reality, but you breach the reality principle, which is also the basis of psychoanalysis. You cannot distinguish between what perception is and what cognition is. So that are the things that are said in ordinary psychology. And my book starts from the negative. My book starts from, well, when you are not in reality, where are you then? What is the sphere a psychotic person is in? When you are not in our ordinary experience of time, where are you? When are you as a psychotic? So those were my basic questions in the first line. Philosophy is the best way to examine what madness entails. And then I have in the first part of my book, I have a kind of, well, a quasi-traditional way of describing the large themes like time, space, perception and cognition. And in my book, in part one, I describe it while the person who describes it, who analyzes it, that's me, of course, that is kind of philosophy, and the data are the psychosis. So you have philosophy about psychosis. And then I base myself on this whole tradition of phenomenological psychiatry. And there's done a lot of work, which is not very well known in psychiatry itself, but I dig this up. And that's my first thesis. But that's only one layer of the book, because in that part I split myself, because I am discussing something in a philosophical way, and I'm discussing facts from psychosis, and those facts from psychosis, these data, are partly from others. I use all these first person accounts from, well, there are many accounts, and also these famous accounts like from Schreber, from Artaud, etc. But I'm split, and what I'm also describing my own psychosis, which I had during this very examination, during this analysis, not in 1987, but in 2007. Then I was doing this examination from as a philosopher into psychosis. And then I come to the second thesis, or the second layer in my book. And that is that philosophy, when you take it seriously, it may well lead to psychosis. This philosophy is the best way to examine psychosis, but it also may well lead to psychosis, because when you, well, then I use all these quotes, of course, from Nietzsche, when you look to, what's it called,
abyss.
Too long into the abyss, then the abyss is looking back into you. That's the second layer, which is, I think, more important in our conversation today. We are discussing philosophy and not how to deal with mental health, I think. And this first layer is more for the mental health section. Well, when this first part starts with philosophy on the one hand and psychosis on the other hand, I'm describing this other hand, these data, from this first level, from philosophy. But this description itself is tending towards psychosis. So in my text, the language of my text is, on the one hand, the language from philosophy, and I'm using it in a serious way. But by using it and extrapolating it towards the extreme, I also show it is a reflection on madness. But by reflecting on madness and by hyper-reflecting on madness, it is also expressing madness in the end. So, and that is a theme that runs through my whole book, this theme of the paradox. The language which I use to describe madness is the language which is not madness itself, but is tending towards madness. And this tending towards madness, in a sense, is already madness. Well, it can be perhaps also expressed quite succinctly on the cover of the book by MIT. It's better than the Dutch cover, which was empty blank. And that's a spiral, and you have this spiral, and in a way that's a symbol or an object which catches this whole philosophy madness intermingling. The spiral in which you are, you can going into the spiral towards what exactly? You're spiraling inside, and you're going further inside, and you are going somewhere. You're concentrating on something. You are neurotically hyper-reflecting, further focusing on a focal point, a vanishing point, which is the center of the circle. And there is something there, or there is nothing. There's this zero or nothingness. And this nothingness, that is the vanishing point where, well, that is where all my text is going towards. That's where it is leading. When you approach it from this perspective, the spiral. On the other hand, the spiral is also going the other way. So the directionality in the spiral is not set beforehand. The spiral is also spiraling outside, and the text is also going outside. And then the point where everything is leading to is not this zero in the middle, but infinity. The spiraling is going outside. It breaks outside of the circle, and it produces endless texts. Well, now I've already said quite various things about what is going on in my book, but also what is going on in psychosis. Those two theses, philosophy about madness. So my book presents many things which people do not know what is going on in psychosis. And then the second thesis we have, philosophy leading towards madness. That's my more favorite theme to discuss. And then this third theme, that's in a way the basis or the source of philosophy is also madness, and not psychosis in the clinical sense of the word, but madness as an intrinsic paradox. A paradox that cannot be resolved in any way.
Do you see any philosophizing as a prerequisite for madness? You know, do all philosophers, to a certain degree, are they dealing with something which is generally would be considered a psychosis? So, do you understand it as any honest or sincere philosophy has got to ride that line where they are, you know, touching on madness at all times?
Yes and no. I'm also when you are doing philosophy and you are like this end of the 19th century MacTaggart. I didn't know whether you know him or, well, he's an analytic philosopher.
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yes, and when we discussed the philosophy of time, this MacTaggart proved that time cannot exist because there are two perspectives on time that we both have to use, but these two perspectives cannot go together. So MacTaggart concluded that time does not exist. There is no such thing as time. But, that's an interesting thought. And philosophers can have many, many thoughts, of course. And they, when philosophers are in their philosophies, they are going somewhere, their mind is going somewhere, and it makes claims about what's what values are, what truth is, what reality is, and they live in their philosophies. And I think when these philosophies have their consequences, they can end up being psychotic. Well, especially when you have philosophies which have ideas in the philosophies that do not that clash with ordinary reality. So ordinary reality is a kind of thing that calls the philosopher back from his thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But
so do you think for an experience of madness, you know, there's something that's there that is there a choice in terms of whether or not the person who becomes psychotic, who becomes mad, there's something that they sort of need to lean into, you know? So there's sort of the infamous, you know, we've already spoken of infinity, so this is somewhat relevant, but one of the more infamous mad, you know, madness episodes in the history of madness is that of Cantor, you know, of exploring exploring infinity. But apparently it wasn't that he was exploring infinity, it was like a combination of that and something else. But what I mean to say is, you know, in these explorations of infinity, something must have begun in Cantor. And do you think there's an agency there to sort for someone to say, I'm going to lean into this madness and see where it goes? Or do you think madness just draws us in? There is no, once that spark of madness begins, you have no choice. You're going to become mad.
Yeah, well, that's a very interesting question, which I do not have definite answers about. But I do know that, I work with persons who have inclinations towards psychosis and madness. So I know quite a lot of people who have been there, who have come back, etc. And I know that there in many psychoses, also in my own psychosis, there is a certain point of no return. It is very difficult to explain, or I cannot explain, why is there a point of no return? I know there was someone I came in touch with who read my book, and I had various conversations with him, and he was reading my book, and he was going into this trip into madness. And he was taking parts from my book, and I discussed with him about these parts of my book, indeed about time, indeed about mysticism, indeed about what's the sense of it all, and what is time, etc. And he was also juggling with all these concepts from Descartes, etc. And he was, I saw him going towards psychosis, and there was no holding back. So, and I could not stop him. Other people could not stop him, and he ended up in a psychiatric hospital. And the only thing that stopped him was medication. And then he came back to Earth. And well, I have a comparison with this. Gardner, this philosophy with this child book, A World of Sophie. I don't know whether that's in the English-speaking world, a famous book.
Sophie's World.
Sophie's World,
yeah.
Yes.
I haven't read it, but I have heard of it. She's taught all the philosophers from Plato through to...
Yes, it's a kind of, for children, a philosophy introduction book. It is quite good. In the book, there are also fictional characters that come alive, and who is the writer of the book, etc. That's what I also like about the book. That's in a way also in my book. But in this book is also given a picture of philosophy. Imagine that the world is like a rabbit, and that we are all hidden in the fur of this rabbit. So you're all beneath. Inside the hairs, between the hairs, and only the philosophers are interested in what, where does the whole, the totality or infinity, where does it come from? And they climb up the hairs of the rabbit, and they come a little outside of the rabbit. And they, when they look outside of the rabbit, because they're not hidden in the fur anymore, on the top of the hair of the rabbit, they may have a vision of the magician who took the rabbit out of the hat. It's a children's book, so it's very funny. But comparison here when we replace the rabbit with an apple tree. And when we see persons, philosophers, they climb into the tree of knowledge and they climb higher and higher, and they see all these branches of knowledge, and they go into this branch and they go into that branch because they want to have some fruits of knowledge, of course. And they climb into the branch and further and further, and they come on the outer reaches of the branches, but they go still further. And there is somewhere a point, at least in psychosis, that they go even further and that they fall out of the tree. Mm-hmm. And then they land on the ground, and then they climb up the tree again. And when they, for the second time, they climb up the tree, they know something about the tree, what the persons who did not fall out of the tree don't know. They know something about gravity. They know something about, well, and it is hard to say what they know. And it's also hard to say why it is that somewhere there is this transition to where you cannot go back anymore. And that, well, that may be the falling out of the tree. And it is a kind of seduction, because you want to reach higher, you want to reach further.
Do you, to sort of expand on this metaphor of this tree,
mm-hmm. So you can also expand it to Plato's cave, mm-hmm. of course. Then we've all been outside, you're all inside again.
Yeah, I think what's interesting with this, though, is that with the idea of the tree, is that mm-hmm. I think it's a bit easier to see that in terms of someone who's, say, not psychotic, what would be deemed normal, yeah. they can sort of look at the tree but keep it at bay, right? They don't let it sort of infect them, they don't have to partake. There's, is there something in the psychotic, in the madman, the experience of the madman, which, completely compels them that they have to mm-hmm. involve themselves? And this is something that comes forth early on in the book. It's this idea that one of the key differences between, I always put it in quotation marks because I hate the word, but normality and psychosis is that the psychotic, they have a true sort of honest involvement with the ideas. Mm-hmm. They any ideas for the psychotic become an active part, of their being. Yeah. So, what is it do you think that just, as I said, compels them, the psychotic, to have to, actually become involved with the ideas that they are theorizing on or thinking about?
Oh, well, I think that is the difference between philosophy and poetry and literature. That when you are writing philosophy, when you are doing a philosophical thought, there is some claim that what you are thinking about, that there is a truth in it, that you are trying to reach a certain kind of reality, and that it is not just for fun, that it is not just for, because you have this academic position and you have to produce four articles a year. You are doing philosophy because it is about the relation, about being in the world, and about this initial wonder about that you are in the world. And then you cannot Well, that's the stance and the stimulus to do philosophy. For I think that's the only stimulus, and the only real stimulus is that you wonder about everything, that you wonder about that you are, about existence itself, and at the same time that this wondering splits itself between reflecting. This there is a kind of reflectional level of thought, and then what you wonder about. So there's a kind of immediately after this first sense of wonder, of pure experience, there is this split, pure experience, thought in consciousness. So you have this one and this two, this split, and this which can drive you towards, well, you're wondering about how do you know that other people have a mind and you also have a mind, and well, all kinds of philosophical questions which you can go towards. But these are serious questions, and when you come into answers on these questions, and you come onto experiences around these questions and answers, these are real experiences, and you cannot just put them aside and think, well, philosophical activity is only one activity among other activities. So it is a kind of an expression of being. And well, I think the same drive to have this wonder and reflection together, and that's also one of my definitions about what the psychosis is, that wonder and reflection are both intensified in a psychosis, in madness, that there is no longer wonder, but there is perplexity. Mm-hmm. And there's no longer reflection, but there's hyper-reflection. And when these two go together, then on the one hand, when it is both becoming intense, it is becoming psychotic, and it is going out of control.
Mm-hmm. So, do you think?
Well, we're still at your question, I think. How does it come? When does it become philosophy, and when does it become psychosis? And these are interesting questions, and we are at the same time, we're still on these similarities. We do not have differences yet, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you just said something interesting there about hyper-reflection there, which I think could pull something out, which is the idea, you know, when we go back to that idea of the normal, the difference between the normal and the psychotic, the normal person just sees something, they reflect on it. But for the psychotic, even if there isn't, they imbue another layer. And is that what you mean by hyper-reflection? They just keep going into something and whether or not there's something there.
Yeah. Yeah, and reflection, reflective thoughts, it follows certain paths. It follows certain paths which have been walked before and which give prototypical examples that you may follow in your thought. And that is reflection. And that reflection is closer to possibility of expression in language, in this discursive language in which one follows the other. And then there's a kind of expression which is communicable. So ordinary reflection is closer to thought, ordinary thought, and to language, and which in hyper-reflection it is the layers of experience, the wild associations are exploding. It is when you have an engine, an ordinary engine, There's also a kind of burning process of fuel. And then there is movement, and that is ordinary rotary movement, which can be controlled. The speed can be controlled in an ordinary engine. But when the fuel is too high, or when the original substances in the engine are a little bit different, there can be explosions, and these explosions of thoughts, they do not correspond to ordinary movement of various engines when you talk about cars, etc. These are like explosions. It's like terrorist bombing into normal life of thoughts. The concepts are flying in all directions. And those explosions. Well, of course, it is the task of a philosopher to, and well, that's in a way what I try to do in my book. My book is a kind of psychosis, but over 800 pages, and so you can read one word and you can read the next word, etc. But when you meet a psychotic person who's totally out of his or her mind, and they can have this experience, these wild jungles of experience, without possibility to express themselves, and without. So I try in my book to follow these explosions and to give words on a discursive level, one after the other, of something which approaches infinity. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what all philosophers do in a sense, and that's what we are supposed to do, aren't we? Create new concepts and let these concepts flourish and make these new connections and make new connections between what concepts are and what percepts are and what conception and perception and how these interfere. Mm-hmm. All in order to reach some kind of reality, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it is a serious business. It's a serious business, I think, because it's poetry is nice, but when poetry is only something when we do not take it seriously, poetry that goes into the poetry books, and that is for entertainment. And philosophers are the ones who demand something from poetry. Poetry that takes you away, brings you somewhere that does not exist but could exist, or to something that is impossible to exist but still thinkable. So perhaps all philosophy is an attempt to express in controllable language and controllable thought what is in poetry.
Mm-hmm. I think what would be helpful, I think at this juncture, would be to almost, I know I'm jumping forward a bit in the questions I sent you here, but would be to introduce mm-hmm. introduce the narrative of a mad episode from you know, one of the ones that I find really intriguing, which is the one I mentioned to you, of Crowhurst, who, for those who don't know, it was a sailing around the world race of 8 people, I think, or maybe 12. Yeah. And Crowhurst got lost 3 days in, I believe, at sea, and goes mad. And we have his notebooks from this journey.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I think this is telling that in the madman then is given this position of absolute constraint, absolute inhumanism, completely, mm-hmm. you know, on the possibly the smallest spatiality you could possibly be, which is a boat. quite literally adrift in the ocean of nothingness.
Yeah.
And, you know, given this hyper-reflection, which is almost mandatory because he has to, all he has as a stimulus is his own thoughts. And I think this is, you know, this is telling of what's happening in that, you know, whether or not he'd gone mad if this hadn't happened, we don't really know, but it's someone put in the position of absolute sort of psychotic constraint.
It is in my book. It is also because I like his case. It did not end very happily because Crowhurst has never been found. It only his empty sailboat was there, and this notebook of his indeed. And he is. I was discussing all this philosophical thought, etc. And in practice, when we are discussing philosophy, we use these names of famous philosophers, and we use these concepts. And in psychosis, not every person who is psychotic has access to all these great philosophers, but they all have access to at least some language with which we have grown up. And Crowhurst, he was an engineer from the UK on this sail race. And I'm not sure whether he had it in his boat, but he was influenced by the thoughts of Einstein. Now, and Einstein is read more, I think, than his popular books than many philosophers. So he was intrigued by this Einstein relativity concept of time, and he was in his writing also trying to find out how he could overcome his situation of being drifting on the sea of nothingness, ending up nowhere. Well, we can take this being on an ocean as a metaphor for life. We are all in a sense, we are all alone, and we are all in this ocean of nothingness, and we know that one day we will not be there anymore. So when we take Crowhurst had this actual situation that he was immediately confronted with this existential situation that he probably would, because also his engine on his boat, he could not go further anymore. He was, so there was this prospect of not getting alive and not staying alive from this sail trip. And he tried to think himself out of time, to think himself out of this existential situation with help of Einstein. And then he was also, well, like this MacTaggart. Well, time does not exist, and there is an infinity of time before myself and an infinity of time after myself, and the sum of plus infinity and negative infinity is exactly zero. And from this point zero, everything is in reach. He was in the center of the spiral of my book. He was exactly in that center. And this phrase, he was in the center of my book, then I say it from the outside. I describe him, me as a person, describe it as he as a person, and on a third person kind of language, that he was at the center. But in fact, we cannot talk about this like that he was in the center, because from his perspective, well, he escaped. He really had found a solution, and I can give a quote, perhaps, because he has somewhere this very funny. Yeah, this is a. He also we discussed before, this transition from still knowing how it is, and then suddenly psychosis takes you with you. And there's a moment that also Carhurst snaps through, and then he says, I quote Carhurst, "You will have trouble with some of the things I have to say. Until recently, 3 days ago, I had a lot of trouble with them myself. I was determined to solve the problem if it took me the rest of my life. Half an hour later, I had set up the basic equations and seen the pattern. 3 days later, I understood everything in nature, myself, in all religion, in politics, in atheism, agnosticism, communism, and systems. I had a complete set of answers to the most difficult problems now facing mankind. I had arrived at the cosmos by contemplating the navel of an ape." Well, there he was. In 3 days' time, he went from examining Einstein's book, thinking about the ocean, thinking about the heavens and the sky, and examining this book, and his mind went further and further, and then he knew it all. He had the solutions to everything. And he was free. He was really free from, well, from what? I don't know, from everything, from time and space. Yeah, well, I can read more about from this Carhurst. He follows, "I was beginning to understand more and more of the cosmic beings. All cosmic beings had to throw themselves on the mercy of one man." So this is the moment. Well, I stop with Carhurst, I think, because it is in a very interesting state, I think. It is when we have this transition from the ordinary state of mind into psychosis, we go, we are in this transition. And what many people know is the state after this transition. Because after this transition, people... Well, we can say it in terms of the Leuze, about whom we discussed last session. We have this deterritorialization. We escape the earth. We escape the territories. And we have a kind of the energy for absolute deterritorialization. But of course, we do not never reach the absolute. And then we re-territorialize. And then we come back on another level or on the same level, but we are back again, and we end up with new dualisms around good and evil, or with a new plan about how the world is. Many come back from this trip to infinity, from this Icarian, from Icarus to the sun and back, they end up in all kind of delusional systems. But between the delusional system after the transition and normalcy, we all know those delusional systems, but between that, there is this transitional moment, and that is a kind of what in shamanism is also described as the opening, as the mystic path towards something in which only the mystic path itself is something which is of value, and which is also, of course, the which is the point of no return, the nothingness at the center of the spiral. And well, Carhurst has reached that point. But, well, what does he do next? He thinks that behind that point, that he can gain this power, and he's seduced by that he can make instruments, that he can make mental technology to remain in that state, And then when he's behind that point, he meets these cosmic beings. And another word in ordinary psychiatry is that he develops delusions. Perhaps he sees persons. Perhaps he thinks them or he sees them. But then he's falling back to earth again. But where he's going towards this transitional phase, well, I think that's the most interesting phase.
I mean, this the idea of a transition already implies layers or something, borders or something to go beyond. And I mean, this question, of course, interests me, this idea of an inside or an outside, whether it's in a Kantian sense, whether it's in a Deleuzian sense. But, you know, we can talk about that. But also what's interesting is whether or not this, the actual very concept of an inside and outside changes during that transition. So what it is you've gone from and into during that transition, what it was when you were there actually changes itself. I mean, do you think that happens, you know, is when the psychotic has this experience and they have this transition, surely what they're looking back upon changes too. So they, in that transition, they become just completely displaced in space and time.
I'm not sure whether I completely understand your addition, but indeed, when you have this, when we follow this idea that there is an insight, and that that during psychosis or all kind of simulations of psychosis, which can be all kinds of texts, it can be all kinds of mystical or hermetic texts, that there is a kind of transition or a way towards the outside. And suppose that you read these texts or that you experience psychosis and you get a sense, perception, cognition, or whatever, you get a sense of this outside. Well, the persons who think that they can express in words and in images what is in this outside, those are the messianic people who run around with that they know what is on the beyond, on the other side. What you say is when you have a sense of the outside and you come back, that then also your idea about the relation between the inside and the outside is changed. What counts as an inside and what counts as an outside is changed.
From what you've learned,
I think so.
Yeah, so it's sort of the black box problem. Once you learn intuitively what's on that outside, you can't go back to this previous state because you've acquired something which is completely other than the norm.
Yes.
So you're sort of caught in a bind. I mean, do you think there's a possibility of complete reversion? It doesn't seem so.
What is it?
Is it, do you think, there's a bit of a, you're caught in a bind that you, you know, there's no possibility of ever attending to that original state that you had. So it's sort of a question of, you know, once you've gone to the outside, you can't go back to how you were before because you've learned something, you've understood something, you've intuited something, which you can't explain to anyone else because it's, as you said, it's not of that language.
Indeed, but equally, exactly.
So then there's the question of, do you sort of stay and perhaps take medication to try get back artificially? Or do you push through? Do you just keep pushing to try get to something in this spiral? Or is that dangerous?
Well, this in the second part of my book, I lean very much on this book by Potvol. And he has written this book, which now is in my book, The Seductions of Madness, that many persons who have been there, they come back. And because there was a lot of anxiety, there was a lot of fear, there was a lot of terror, etc., in their whole journey, other people say to them, well, take your medication so you never have to go there. You never have to dwell in those lonely, terrible states. Perhaps outside. They do not use the word outside, but you do not have to go there anymore. And people take the medication because, well, they should not be psychotic. Mm-hmm. But there is, among many, many psychotic persons I know, this sense that they were going somewhere, that they have this succession of revelation after revelation and revelation and revelation, and also revelation with a capital R of any revelation, this opening of the world, this seeing the world for the first time in your life as a kind of awakening, as a kind of a real red pill which you swallow. And they have all had this sense of that they had been somewhere which was of amazingly high value, and they all want to go back there because it was madness. The things they said, they were not true. They hurt themselves and they hurt others, etc. But there was a sense that it was realer than real, and that's also in the first chapter of my book. This strange feeling afterwards, after the psychosis, that you have been somewhere that was not real at all, hypo real, I call it. It's like a dream. It is not real. It is not in connection with ordinary reality, with other persons in the ordinary functioning, etc. So it is subreal. It is hypo real, but in a sense, it is also hyper real. Also connected to this hyper reflection, it is more real than anything else. So indeed, people long to go back there. Well, and they have to be indoctrinated by psychiatry. Well, that's very bad. That's not good for you, etc. So they do not go back there. But there, in the back of their minds, they think, yes, but I know. And what they know, they cannot say. And it is of course not, because that's often a suggestion or a thing that they know together with another people who have been there, and that there is a kind of secret conspiracy, kind of secret society of people who know the illuminated against the others who are not illuminated. And well, this is something that lives, of course. But when it is about knowing, and when it is about being illuminated, it is not knowing, of course, in the ordinary sense of the word. It is not knowing that you can express further in propositions or in practical content. And it's not illuminated perhaps. But then we have to take this metaphors of light, and we have to follow what it can mean, this being enlightened or being illuminated, and how it also functions with ordinary enlightenment and with following rationality, etc. What the difference are when someone says, I'm enlightened. Mm-hmm.
Do you think this gives, you know, we've already mentioned phenomenology, and you have sort of psychiatric phenomenology, but I mean, in strictly philosophical terms, do you think this actually opens up the discussion of phenomenology, but frustratingly, it's away from one which language can ever attend to? So we can't really describe this phenomenology, because any language we use is already within the previous iteration of the world, right? The place we didn't go to.
Yes, and yes, indeed, and that's also a kind of shift in my book. In a certain sense, I use quite a lot of this phenomenology, and then I use some quotes from first-person accounts, and I give a kind of phenomenological interpretation of what those first-person accounts mean, and then I expand what we know about possibilities of experience. So what are possible experiences, etc.? How do you experience time and space? So that's the phenomenology. But when I think I make also somewhere this comparison, the phenomenologist is on the shore, is on fast, firm ground. And the person who experiences something is in the water, like Crowhurst. That's the person who is drowning. And this slowly drowning or this falling out of the apple tree, the phenomenologist, well, all in spite of that he or she uses all this first person experience tales, these expressions of first person experience, the phenomenologist remains outside that experience of the psychosis itself. So that remains stuck into this phenomenological language. And when you want to understand what psychosis is, phenomenology is not enough. It is a kind of translation of something that is deeply untranslatable, which is something that is not fit for language. And what in my book, there's this transition from phenomenological language towards mystical language, and to explore what mysticism and what we know about mystical language and what we know about mystical experience, to bring that into contact with what we know or how we experience psychosis. And then my book gets more momentum from this first part to this second and third part of these tracks together, the mystical path and the psychotic path. What are the differences and what are the similarities?
Mm-hmm. And you know, this idea of language, this idea of you know, going somewhere and then not being able to translate it. This for me brings that really interesting question of a multitude of psychotic experiences have intense relations with numerology and number. And do you think this is what this is? This ability or this this sort of teleology where you have to form a new language, otherwise we can't get anywhere. And it seems that there's something in numbers and, you know, and numerals, which, I mean, I always, you know, he's one of my favorites, but Kant even talks about this as one of the synthetic a priori, you know, that numbers are this thing which almost transcend, and not even transcendental, but they transcend that phenomena and noumena divide by being the thing which definitely works in real experience and in representation. Yeah. And it seems that the, you know, psychotics take this on as a, like, the language of the cosmos, the language of the mystical.
Yeah. Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I fully agree, because it is with these numbers with yes, indeed, what you say or what Kant says about when you are in this psychotic or mystical state and you have thoughts and you have reality, you have concepts and you have percepts, everything is in a kind of flux. Everything is fluid. The outer world, shapes, meanings, identities is all fluid. But what as a skeleton remains, which is and in the outside world and in the inside world, and which is a kind of a vehicle, which is between those two worlds, as a kind of third dimension, or as a basic skeleton of all narratives, is our numbers. So 1, 2, 3, etc. And it's in your mind and it's in the outside world. And well, there are indeed simple proofs that numbers play a very important role in psychosis, because in in all these psychotic systems, numbers play their roles. The people are so-called confused about what numbers mean. So they take the number of a house or of the postal or their zip code as meaning something else. So the numbers which are in the world and in their minds and all together, those numbers, that when you are psychotic, you see that inside the numbers, there are other possibilities than only this world. And then you see this, the various numbers in other constellations. And then you get to these other worlds. Well, and the structure of my whole book, because I was fascinated by the number four. I know many people have been fascinated by the number 23. Number 23 is also this famous, well, not so famous, this movie, which is also as its title, number 23. There are other numbers, and indeed there's a kind of link with numerology and with Kabbalistic, etc., which also is of importance of the more fringe philosophy and analyzing. You can see in certain philosophers also a hidden preference for numbers. But of course, dialectics, it's all with three numbers. And it was Meister Eckhart who said that the number two is the number of the devil. You should never have this only this number two. So there's something wrong with dualisms and with binaries, etc. So numbers have so many associations. And when you go into this psychosis, these numbers, they are super real. So you navigate on this in these numbers. And well, the number four, I discuss the value of the number four in my book, but it is also the groundwork of my whole book. It has four parts. Every part is divided in four chapters, and this it is a theme in my book, the number four.
Okay. Is that a personal number to you, or did you find something there?
No. Well, it was. I was at the time of my second psychosis. I have done a PhD in linguistics. And after my PhD in linguistics, I've been working for a while at the academia in linguistics, doing empirical field work, etc. But I always had this psychotic memories to I wanted to work them out. And then I wrote my first book. And I started to study philosophy again. And I was writing a thesis about the experience of time in psychosis. And this thesis, well, just accidentally, I thought it would be a good idea to approach time and the experience of time in psychosis from four angles. That's where this number four came into, and those were the angles of Husserl, Deleuze, Aristotle and Plotin, and so and then you have these four conceptions. So I had this in my master thesis about psychosis in time, this number four, and I coupled these four to earth, water, air, and fire. And these are as metaphors also form a kind of groundwork of my whole book. So number four and these four elements. Well, and then my master thesis about philosophy in time, which is also in my book, but a bit distributed over several chapters. After having written this thesis about what time is in psychosis, etc., and in these four metaphors, then I became psychotic, and then I came into the isolation cell, etc., with this psychosis, and then I suddenly knew that everything I had written, and that, well, that's perhaps a link with Nick Land, whom we discussed before, I knew that everything I had written about psychosis was Well, it was like straw. It was nothing, because at that moment when I was psychotic, I knew that these four angles on time all pointed towards one point in the center of those four. And that was the quintessential element. And I thought, when I was on this top of psychosis and when I was outside, I thought, when I go inside, when I'm inside again, I'm going to write it all down, what it is like.
Did you ever discern what that final point was? You know, what was the teleology of your psychotic experience?
Well, I would only say that is the heart of the matter, the inside the zero inside the spiral. And when we, let me say one thing about this four. Perhaps I turned 40 at that time. And then I got also this thinking that four and 40 and people with less experience and with more experience, that four is a kind of division line between people who know from the secret conspiracy, from the secret society, and people who do not know. So it run off into delusional thoughts. And this quintessential element, I've called it also a crystal, and then this element of crystal. In my book, there are a few symbols or objects motifs that are a kind of thread that bind the whole together, and the spiral. A symbol and a concept, and also the crystal, also as a name of crystal, she also plays a role, and as a kind of love, or where you want to go, what you're longing at, which is unreachable, etc. And also this, what we have not discussed yet, but this Möbius ring. That's also in English the same name,
yeah.
I think. The Möbius ring, which is kind of two-dimensional stroke of paper, which is bent in such a way that you can only discuss what it is in a three-dimensional space. Mm-hmm. And this Möbius ring, which has, in fact, and that's interesting for this inside-outside discussion, a Möbius ring is made of paper. I don't know whether the listeners know immediately what a Möbius ring is, but when you have a larger stretch of paper, and the ends of it, one end you turn 180 degrees, and you make it, stick it to the other end, then you have a Möbius ring. And when you are at one part of the Möbius ring and you want to get to the other side, or you want to get to the outside, how you reach that outside is just walking the Möbius ring, follow it, and then you come to the other side. And then you are the other side. And the other side is... then you are the other side, but then there is still that other side where you are not. So it's always at the other hand or the other side of where you are, and it can be reached. And when you are there, you can use this metaphor for quite a lot of things. And I've used it also. I don't know if we still have time to elaborate on this. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
When we talk about this going outside and going back again, I think that when we think about philosophy and philosophical thought, I think that in science fiction, many more things are explored than in other kinds of literature. And there is this Roger Zelazny with this with his book in English. It is Doorways in the Sand, I think. And he proposes that there would be a machine, so-called Renius machine. And what this Renius machine does is mirror things. And when you have, well, we all know what happens in a mirror. Then what you see in a mirror is the opposite of before the mirror. And there is behind the mirror, there is a mirror world in which everything is opposite. When you are normally right-handed in the mirror world, you are left-handed. And in fact, at the other side of the mirror, one dimension has been turned around. It is the other way. And everything in the mirror world is going the other way. And what happens in the Renius machine is that you go into the Renius machine, you come out of the Renius machine, and you are in this mirror world. But this mirror world is still the same world as where we are today. Only the only difference is, well, what's the difference? Roger Zelazny gives there a whole description of in his book. Everything has changed, and everything is still the same. But yeah, everything is wrong, but it is difficult to say what, because you come out of the Renius machine and you look to your right hand, but you turn your head and it is your left hand, and you look outside and what you see is the same world, but you are disoriented. You are disoriented in space. Well, this Renius machine, what it... Well, I've used it also as a metaphor to discuss this inside and outside. When we are in a two-dimensional world on paper, we can suppose this is this book, this Flatland, it's called, I think, Flatlanders. And in that world of Flatlands, when you have a graph, a letter, for instance, the D, when you turn that D around, you have a P. You can make from a D a P. And from a B, from book, you can turn that into a Q. Yes, so B and Q and P and D are translatable into each other. They are turnable, reversible in the Flatlanders world. But when you want to make from out of a D, a B, that is impossible in Flatlanders. The only thing to do that is to assume that there is an extra dimension, that there's not only two dimensions of Flatland, but that you can take this D from the paper and you can turn it around in three-dimensional space and then put it back onto the paper. And then you have turned it around. Another way to see this D as a B is to look at this D not from the front side of this paper, but from the back side, where you can only come when the architecture of the Flatlanders world is like a Möbius ring. Well, when we transpose this metaphor to the Renius machine, in the Renius machine, a left-hand glove, you throw a left-hand glove into the Renius machine, and it comes out of the Renius machine, and it is a right-hand glove. And it is still in this world. It was in this world as a left-hand glove. It comes back in this world as a right-hand glove. And where was that glove inside the Renius machine? How did it turn around? It can only be turned around when it was somehow outside this world, outside our space and outside our time. And when we see the madman before the transition, as in the normal world, and when we see the madman after his transition, as in also in the normal world, but confused in this delusional system in which everything is turned around, then somewhere between in this transition is done in the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a metaphor. That's the Renish machine with which you can do things to explore what space is and what time is and how we can, what you can say about these things. We still do not know anything about this outside, because even say that the dimensionality of space is changeable in a way. Well, what? How then? And especially with time, when we say that, when we assume that time, when we go with Kant, that time has something to do with counting, and that we only know about time because we can count. Can you turn time around, or can you get outside of time by doing something with this counting, by seeing that all numbers are only number zero, or that they explode to infinity? Does mm-hmm. there happen something with time? Perhaps, I don't know. Does that do something to experience of time, the concept of time, or an absolute notion of time? Well, that those are questions I don't know answers. Psychotic persons have many answers to these questions.
This is what I was going to ask, because obviously the psychotic can't really trust the signs and symbols of the world. You know, the thing the outside they intuited, they can't explain in language. So mm-hmm. we are left with all these intuitions and experiences which are written but not exact. You know, do you think after a philosophy of madness there can actually be any answers, clarifiable answers from this, or do we have to sort of develop some new means of understanding to actually understand these all together? Can there be any answers to the experience of the psychotic, I guess, is the big question.
Do you mean that after the philosophy of madness we can express psychosis, or
we can express it, but you know, in what sense can we understand there to be any truth in these claims if they can't be explained in the language of the inside?
Yes, I think that those truths are a kind of horizon that is with all kinds of truths, kind of horizons which we cannot really, which we do have or not have. They give perspectives, I think, not answers, or they give directions, or they give food for thought, or they give new energy for other, well, let me not say other dimensions, but other kinds of discourse.
So that's, you know, the experience of a psychotic is an expansion of a questioning of what we supposedly already know. You know, the idea of these firm grounds that the phenomenologist has, etc. We should really utilize the experiences of psychotics and madness to expand this law.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, getting on a little bit here, is there anything that you would like to say about the book that we haven't? I mean, one thing I will say, I mean, I say this with most interviews, but especially with this book, we haven't even scratched we haven't even touched the surface here of what is in it. So I think for anyone who's enjoyed these conversations that I've had with Wouter, really get this book, because there is, as Wouter said, you know, 800 page text which explores every sort of intricacy of madness you would like to know. But if there is something you would like to add that you feel is particular that you'd like to add, then please do.
No, I think we have we've discussed very what for me myself are important points, namely, well, we can stress, we can put the stress on a philosophy of madness. My preferable stress is on philosophy, a philosophy of madness, and that's what I very much enjoyed discussing with you, the philosophy of madness. And I could add many things, but that's for other kinds of interviews, a philosophy of madness. Yeah, exploring more of this actual, real life, psychotic persons, etc. But with a philosophy of madness, I think we have discussed as far as it is possible to discuss the paradoxes of language and especially of time. Yeah, we can go on about time. I don't know. Because,
is there something you want to add about time?
No, it's in my book, and we've discussed it. It's
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Whereabouts can we purchase the book?
Purchase the book?
Yeah. Whereabouts?
Yes, it is. It is on all digital bookstores like Amazon, etc.
Mm-hmm.
It is published by MIT Press, and in some bookshops that are still open in these lockdown times, it is also purchasable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Are you working on any...
distributed worldwide? So
okay, yeah. I'll make sure to put links in the description. Is there anything you're working on now, or are you sort of taking a break?
I'm working on a kind of a new book in which I use this metaphor of crystal,
mm-hmm.
Which I also use for time, and I in which I try to work out on a more planetary global level what it means to live in our times, and which is about the expected future of possible all kinds of apocalypses or catastrophes, but catastrophes which may happen or not happen slowly or fastly, and about the way we our attitudes in time also towards the future. Well, it is. In my new book, that has not four parts. You can also cut this from the interviewer, but it's my new book has not four parts, but only three parts. And the first of the three parts is a phenomenology,
mm-hmm.
of what happens to persons when they know not only that they will die one moment in the future, but when they know that there is a... Well, there is a chance that all of humanity will die, that all these ecological catastrophes, that it is possible that climate change will go on and on, and that all these catastrophes are coming. What's the phenomenology? And then I discuss anxiety, I discuss depression, and I discuss not the post-traumatic stress disorder, but the pre traumatic stress disorder, the trauma of events which are coming, not the events which have happened, and how these traumas of war in the past interfere with traumas of possible turmoil in the future. And this phenomenology part I have finished, and now I'm trying to develop with this metaphor of crystal a way of being in time. Yeah, but that's not finished yet.
Okay, how long till that's out, or is that just, have you just begun that?
No, I've nearly finished it. I hope that it will be published at the end of this year in Dutch. It is in Dutch.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Any possibility of a translation?
Yes, if when you know a publisher, I have a Dutch publisher, and of course he has contacts with English publishers. But yes, I would love to have it translated. And it is well, this a philosophy of madness. It is fed by much phenomenology, much on a kind of more individual level of psychosis. And in my new book, yeah, it is more about the past and the future of mankind and all this. Yeah, it is on another level. It's not about individual psychotic journeys, but it is on the, yeah, it's also about technology, etc., and about yeah, what is it to be human or to be non-human, and yeah,
Okay.
but we'll see where that leads. Yeah. What are you working on there?
I'll just finish up the interview before.
Okay.
Okay. So Walter, thanks very much.
Thank you.